Accession number 15744, reel 1.
Mr. Dunford, reel 1.
Where were you born, please?
In Bristol.
Which year was this?
That was in 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a foreman in a chocolate manufacturing factory.
Did you go to school in Bristol?
In Bristol, yes.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I sat my matriculation exam when I was 15, and at 15 and a half I was at work in an office.
Were you still doing that kind of job when war broke out?
Yes, I was in the office on the Friday afternoon of September the 1st when I heard that as a reservist I was to be mobilised.
How did you react to that?
Well, I was 19. I suppose it was something new and exciting.
And to Chamberlain's declaration of war?
Again, the same reaction. I was then in the headquarters of the local RAF Volunteer Reserve unit in Bristol. As I'd joined the reserve during the early 1939, at the time when everyone joined something.
Why had you chosen the RAFVR?
I don't know. The possibility of being trained as a pilot was glamorous, I think.
Where were you trained as a pilot?
I did my first hour or two of actual flying at an airfield at Weston-super-Mare. Then my mother became ill with, I think, diphtheria, which at that time was an infectious disease. So I didn't go to any more flying training. Then, of course, the war broke out, and as a reservist, I was mobilised, although I knew nothing.
Did you find it easy to learn to fly?
Oh, yes. My actual flying proper started in fairly early 1940 at Red Hill. Suddenly Red Hill was evacuated because Dunkirk was coming up, so we were hastily whipped away to some airfield in Kingston, Carlisle, where I finished my initial flying.
So you never went abroad to do any training like some of them?
No, I didn't go abroad to do my own training. I was, as an instructor, posted abroad.
What was your attitude towards actually flying in combat?
Well, that was the natural expectation when one became a pilot. But in fact, my life was undoubtedly saved because when I had completed my wings course, obviously a group of instructors were sat in a back room allocating people to various duties, and I imagine they were going down the list saying bomber, fighter, transport, instructor, and someone designated me as a potential instructor. So after doing an instructor's course during 1940, I did some instructing in England, and I was then posted overseas to South Africa and Rhodesia as an instructor in what was then called the Empire Air Training Scheme, later to become the Commonwealth Air Training Plan. So I was actually mainly in Rhodesia for almost 3 years. I was a good instructor, but in the meantime, of course, I was acquiring a lot of experience, so that when I returned to the UK in the summer of 1944, I had the best part of 3,000 hours experience behind me. And when my question of allocation of new duties came up, it was suggested to me that the Mosquito squadrons wanted fairly experienced people, including instructors, because apparently mosquitoes are obviously operating at a very high. The mosquito bombers were operating from 25,000-30,000 feet, and coming back into a very, very black England. Sorry. They apparently there were a number of accidents where pilots had settled into a long steady descent from nearly 30,000 feet and went down and down and down until they'd hit the ground, because they've been so stabilised in their descent, and without any lights there were no warning. So it was felt useful to have pilots who had a lot of night flying instrument flying practice, so that they might be more wary of this problem.
If I can ask you some questions, please, about the Empire Air Training Scheme in Rhodesia. Which years were you instructing there? Which 3 years would that have been?
I arrived in South Africa early in 1941. I'd actually had my 21st birthday on the troop ship going out. After 3 or 4 months in South Africa, I should explain that the posting wasn't to South Africa. When I went out on the troop ship, we went as a complete unit with CO, engineers, instructors, bound for Eastleigh, Nairobi, to establish a new flying training school there. But around that time, there was trouble in the Middle East with the Italians, I believe, Somaliland. So it was decided that Eastleigh, Nairobi would be more usefully employed on an operational basis. So the entire school was simply offloaded in South Africa and dispersed. We were no longer a unit, and we were just odd bods in various places. And after about 3 or 4 months, I was then posted up to Rhodesia, where I joined a flying school as a proper full-time instructor.
So it would have been 41 to 44?
So I was in Rhodesia instructing from the middle of 41 until, I think it was May of 44, when I was posted from Rhodesia back to the UK. In fact, on D-Day, I was in a transit camp in Durban waiting for a ship home. D-Day, that would be in June 6th, yes.
Whereabouts in Rhodesia did you do your instructing?
I was instructing on Oxford's at Heaney near Bulawayo for about 6 months. Then I went to Thornhill, which was near Gwello in Rhodesia, for the rest of the time there until May 44. And that was on Harvard's.
How do you spell Heaney?
Heaney is H-E-A-N-Y.
What did you think of the Empire Air Training Scheme during the war, from your own personal experience?
Oh, I think it worked very, very well indeed. In Rhodesia, of course, we had good weather and a complete lack of any interference from enemy activity, so that training could go ahead without any interruption whatsoever. We were instructing first of all South African and Rhodesian young men, and then of course drafts of trainees came out from England thereafter.
What was the attitude of these young men from Southern Africa towards the war?
Oh, well, they were full of enthusiasm. Obviously, like all aircrew, they were volunteers. They were keen.
And the general population in Rhodesia and South Africa?
Oh, very, very hospitable. In the main, in South Africa, there were an element of the old Boer population who were actually basically anti-British and. There were the odd cases of people being beaten up by I think it were members of the Ossova Brafag, I think was the name of the Boer organisation, which was so anti-British. But in the main, I should stress that all of the South Africans and certainly all of the Rhodesians were most hospitable indeed.
Did you personally come across any of the hostility in South Africa?
No.
Did you hear of anybody personally who got beaten up?
No, I suppose it was folklore. I did see one odd incident. I think in Durban, I believe. This was involved between the Ossa Bronfa and the South African police, where one chap had actually sort of been stripped naked, I think, and marched down the street and more or less sort of thrown at the ranks of the police who were blocking a demonstration. That's a long time ago now.
Who was the individual?
I think he was a member of the sort of pro-British police.
You witnessed that?
I actually witnessed this. Yes, yes.
Was anybody injured?
No. It was a demonstration.
How do you spell Ossifa Bronfa?
I think it's Ossewa, and Bronfa, Brondwag.
Did you have any problems yourself on the Empire training scheme?
None at all. As I say, most of my time there was spent at Thornhill outside Gwello, and the populace there were most hospitable. In fact, some places provided us with a sort of home from home. I was a sort of free to come and go in the home of the local native commissioner, and they were very, very good indeed. Hussey, that's right. I was groping for their name, yes. Mr. and Mrs. Hussey. Hulley, Hulley.
Did you have any notable pilots who passed through your hands?
I'm not aware. I understand that Tony Benn was a pupil in the scheme in Rhodesia, but I think he went through later than my period there. Certainly I never knew of that at that time.
Now, you started to tell me about how you went on to operations. Can you pick up the story from there, please?
Yes, when I came back from Rhodesia in the summer of 1944, I went to the Air Ministry, and they then gave me a choice: the mosquito bomber operations or to go to transport. And I felt that at this stage of the war, it was about time I saw something of the front line, so I did opt for mosquito operations. So that I was then posted to first to the training unit and then to 608 Squadron, which was based at Downham Market. Although this squadron was in 8 Group Pathfinder Force, it was not in fact a marker squadron. It was a part of what was called the Light Night Striking Force, and we didn't actually do any marking ourselves. Our role was in diversionary raids, spoof raids, and also our main target also always was Berlin, so that in my total of 55 trips, 27 of those, exactly half a tour, was to Berlin, and some of the others were originally planned for Berlin and were then subsequently altered at the last moment because of adverse weather conditions.
What was Downham Market like to fly from?
Oh, it was excellent. It's south of King's Lynn, dead flat, so there's absolutely no worries about high ground or any of the other hazards. Obviously, one of the hazards on flat, wet ground is fog, but Downham Market was one of those stations that was equipped with FIDO, so that some of our operations, particularly across the Christmas New Year period during the Ardennes offensive, whilst much of England, eastern England, was shrouded in fog, we were still operating out of Downham Market. And in fact, when I looked to see my operations just around that time, three or four of those targets were actually behind the Ardennes sector, so that whilst we couldn't strike at the advanced German forces in the Ardennes, we could hit at the supply bases, railway junctions, and that sort of thing behind the offensive.
And 608 Squadron, were you happy with the squadron?
Oh yes, it was very, very good indeed. When I got there first, we had an Australian squadron commander. When he was posted, we then had an RAF officer, wing commander, who had previously been a navigator before he became a pilot.
What did you feel about flying the Mosquito?
Oh, it was a beautiful airplane.
Was there anything that you didn't like about it?
No, it had very, very few vices. If you let it, it would swing on takeoff when it was heavily loaded, but if you knew about that in advance, then you could cope with it.
Do you remember your first raid?
Yes, my first raid was on Wilhelmshaven. Not too far, not as far to go as many. Our route was out over the North Sea. And we bombed on our markers and went. In a sense, I suppose it was a relief to have done the first one and got away with that. My second raid then was to Berlin.
What was the actual method of conducting an operation with the Light Night Striking Force?
Oh, it was very, very well organized indeed. Coming back from Rhodesia, where all the equipment was a bit basic and out of date, it was quite a revelation to come back to Bomber Command onto Mosquitoes and find excellent voice radio. And I do remember being told that on the way out, the marker aircraft would fire very light route markers to group up the force into a cohesive group. And I remember being told that route markers would be fired off at such and such a time, and I thought, this I must see. But sure enough, spot on time, there were four or five very lights, all very close together, each being fired by a separate aircraft doing its own navigation. This was a revelation to me. I didn't think it would work. And of course, as we ran up to the target, about a minute before we get there, the marker aircraft ahead of us were marking. And in general, our markers were actually called down individually, because the Germans were so good at letting off dummy markers away from the target out in the fields, that as soon as the first markers burst and they could say they were greens, then the Germans would let off false markers away from the target, away in the fields, so that we shouldn't be deceived and our bomber would be dispersed. Each marker was called down by an aircraft, so you'd be listening out and suddenly you'd hear someone say, Black Boy 2 marker gone, and within just a few seconds after that you'd actually see the marker burst and cascade, so you knew that it was a genuine marker. So that the most target would be marked by, say, six aircraft, so that you'd actually see five or six target indicators burst and cascade together, giving you a fairly tight bombing area, target area. In those targets which were within oboe range, then the marking was excellent, and it was very, very tight indeed, because oboe was such an excellent marker. On more distant targets, Berlin for instance, the method of marking was by H2S, which was a form of radar in the nose of each aircraft. But some targets, including Berlin, are rather difficult to read on radar screens, and H2S marking was undoubtedly more scattered. I suppose it's this scattering of markers which gives rise to the story about indiscriminate area bombing. Obviously, there's no point in going for indiscriminate area bombing, so that all targets were selected for their specific military value. But because of the difficulty of marking them, and because of the enemy opposition, of course, it was not always so easy to have accurate, truly accurate bombing.
Were there any criticisms you had of the marking system yourself?
No, I wasn't a marker, so I would be in no position to criticise. As I say, the H2S marking was not as tight as oboe, but oboe marking itself was really good, really good. It would give quite a tight group of five or six markers on which you should bomb.
We've got your logbooks here, and I noticed that Wilhelmshaven raid, which started you off, was actually on the 9th of October. How important was it for you to have the same aircraft as a pilot?
It wasn't terribly important. They were all standard. It really wasn't very practical, because the aircraft were being flown both by day and by night, so that if one did four or five operations in a week, then obviously the aircraft was being used by other people at other times.
Now, as you said, your next operation, which was actually the 11th of October, was Berlin itself. What kind of reaction would you get at a briefing when it was announced that Berlin was the target?
Well, when the curtain was drawn aside and one could see the route markers going all the way, it was kind of, oh, the big city again. Obviously, this was the hardest target, because it was more distant than others. And of course, the defences were much greater at Berlin than others, both radar-controlled guns and searchlights. The searchlights were quite unnerving, really. I know light in itself doesn't do you any harm, but many of the searchlights were radar-controlled, extremely accurate. And of course, as soon as the radar control had searchlight had picked you up, then a cone of maybe 15 or 20 other searchlights would pick you up as well. And after that, the light was so intense that you felt it was shining through the bottom of the aircraft, literally. You could virtually see, and all you could do is to get your head down and try to concentrate on the instruments and wriggle around as much as you could, because whilst the lights themselves don't do any harm, their whole purpose was to eliminate one for the use of the fighters, which were waiting for just that purpose. And of course, because of the intensity of the glare, one couldn't see anything outside the aircraft. It was no good looking to see if there were any fighters around, because the glare was so intense that nothing else could be seen. So all one could do was to wriggle and dive. And as one moved across Berlin, so one would be handed over from cone to cone, so that once held by the lights, you really couldn't leave the lights until you're outside the city zone.
Which did you fear the most, the flak or the night fighters?
The flak, I think, is worse. Because again, that was radar controlled and it was extremely accurate. We were able to, because of the quality of our bomb sight, which was a very good gyro stabilized bomb sight, we didn't have to maintain a dead straight level run in for minutes and minutes before, as some of the older LAX had to do. but the guns were good. One occasion I bet against them and lost. Once one had released the bombs, one was supposed to run straight for 40 seconds whilst a camera in the belly of the aircraft took a picture of the target marker on which you had aimed your bombs, with the possibility of picking up some sort of street plan beneath to try to identify accurately where the marker and where the bombs had fallen. That 40 second run, as I say, should be done straight. On one occasion during my run, the warning light in the cockpit lit up. We had a device called Boozer, the code name was Boozer. This detected the incoming radar signals from radar controlled guns, and also on a different light, radar controlled night fighters, radar guided night fighters. And on this occasion, as my 40 second run was almost complete, the light came up indicating I was being vectored by the guns, and I kidded myself I had long enough to finish the 40 second run and turn away, and suddenly the shell burst right underneath the aircraft, and that's when my aircraft was quite seriously disabled.
Which operation was that on?
Oh, that was my 40 second raid to Berlin.
Sounds as though it made a very, very marked impression to be able to remember exactly which number it was.
Well, I suppose I've counted back since. I've counted back since to find out how many. That was the first real damage I'd sustained. And on that occasion, I found myself over Berlin, pointing in an easterly direction, with various damage to the aircraft, principally the fact that I had absolutely no aileron control at all.
What then happened about trying to get it back?
We cleared away the hatches ready to jump, but reminding ourselves that jumping into Berlin immediately after a raid was not a particularly healthy activity. The second option was to keep going east towards the Russian lines, but again I wasn't sold on that idea, so I reverted to back to my old instructing days and went on to the secondary effective controls. That is, whilst the lateral aircraft is controlled by the ailerons, if you put on enough rudder, you can actually turn and bank the aircraft by heavy booting of the rudder. And I was able, under these conditions, to actually turn the aircraft round on a westerly heading, and set off for home. One of the effects of the shell was to puncture one of the fuel tanks, so that I knew I had lost some fuel, so that instead of following the laid down return route with the rest of the group, I elected to take a straight line home, which meant that I was no longer within the group. I was an isolated aircraft, and in due course the Boozer light on the aircraft lit up again, indicating to me that I was now being vectored by